We'll now hear 08-AP-2759-CR, State v. Daniel Hansen. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Hansen is Robert Hennick. Mr. Hennick, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I represent Daniel Hansen on this appeal. The issue before this Court, continuing a trend this day, is issues of statutory interpretation. The two primary issues are, number one, what is meant by the language willful or wanton disregard in the felony fleeing statute. The second primary issue is what is the meaning of the term victim in 904.04 sub 1b. Addressing first the felony fleeing charge. Obviously, under the Kalal decision, when we are addressing issues of statutory interpretation, first we have to look at the language of the statute. And in looking at that language, our position is that willful or wanton disregard in this case should be given the historical meaning that is applied in other cases to willful or wanton, and is not, as the State suggests, merely knowingly. The primary reason for that is that if we interpret this as merely knowingly, then it renders the language willful or wanton disregard as mere surplusage. That is for two reasons. Number one, there already is a knowingly requirement in the statute. Statute requires knowingly elude or knowingly flee or attempt to elude. So we already have the requirement of knowingly in the statute, and if we then interpret that this is done by knowingly disregarding something else, then we're merely repeating ourselves and we are ignoring the fact that the legislature chooses its words, or we have to assume that the legislature chooses its words to precisely convey its meaning. So when we look at the language of the statute first, we see that the legislature chose these specific words, willful or wanton disregard. Now, these words have a long tradition in Wisconsin, a long recognized meaning, going back to the 1800s with the Preston case, 1909 in the Brown case, as meaning something more than mere knowingly or intentionally. That is, intentionally is just intending to do an act or intending to omit an act. But under Brown and Preston, willfully, as applied in criminal cases, means also an intent to do wrong. That is, not just to do the act, but to do something that you know is wrong. And the reason why that matters in this case is because if willfully is read as it has historically been read in criminal cases, then there is a good faith defense. If you believe, as Mr. Hansen conceitedly, I think, believed, that his actions were necessary to protect himself, even though objectively the jury found that to be wrong. If he subjectively believed it, then his intent was not to do wrong. His intent was to protect himself. Now, if we look at the other language in the statute, we also have wanton, which the dictionary definitions also include the same sense of malice that is referred to in Preston and Brown. And again, that takes us to an intent to do wrong, not just an intent to do the act. If we look at disregard, that itself, just going back briefly to the State's argument, disregard itself already has a knowing element built into that word. So if we go to the State's, accept the State's argument, then once again, we're just reading out part of the statute, because knowingly disregard is redundant itself. You don't disregard something you don't know. There is something built in there that I only disregard if the court tells me to shut up. I know that the court has told me to do that, and I disregard that. That's what disregard means. But if the court is merely thinking that this guy should be quiet, I don't have that knowledge. So therefore, I'm not disregarding anything. I am merely blathering on when I should be sitting down. So, number one, the language of the statute. The state's argument cannot be correct because it merely reads out willful or wanton. On the other hand, our reading of the statute makes sense because that's historically what is applied to similar words.
Counselor, as I read the statute, the knowingly in the statute says knowingly flee, and the willful and wanton goes to disregard of a signal. So can you perhaps tell me why willful and wanton couldn't also be knowingly? Is it because the legislature would have used the same word twice if they believed it should be having the same meaning? I'm not quite following your argument.
Okay, that certainly is one of the reasons that the statute was enacted in 1965, which was, of course, 10 years after the major revisions of the statute that put the essential mens rea elements of, you know, intent, meaning intentionally or knowingly, in the statutes, and that was the main focus of the mens rea. The legislature obviously knew in 1965 that if it intended knowingly, it knew how to do it. That's shown in the same statute, earlier in the same statute. They used knowingly when they meant knowingly. We have to assume that if they used different language in exactly the same statute, and only a few words later, that they meant something different by that language. Now, in more directly addressing the court's question, knowingly, the actual language of the statute is, no operator of a vehicle shall knowingly flee or attempt to elude any traffic officer by willful or wanton disregard. So it's not just
disregard of such signal.
Of such signal, yes.
Right.
And then so as to
signal being a visual or audible signal by a traffic officer.
Exactly.
It's not a traffic signal.
Right. It's the lights on the police car or the siren from the police car. So knowingly flee or attempt to elude is the main actus reus. And then the next clause, by willful or wanton disregard, is how that actus reus has to be committed. So it's not saying that's something separate or something different. It is how the actus reus is carried out. So since the actus reus already has to be knowing, if we're saying that the particular manner in which the act has to be carried out has to be adding again the language knowing to that, it's just repeating yourself in doing that because it's already part of the actus reus. Now, I know that the Court of Appeals and I think it's Stenzinger split off the by willful or wanton disregard so as to endanger or interfere with. But logically, when we're talking about the manner in which the act is carried out, the word knowingly would flow throughout that. You don't knowingly do something accidentally. And if we say that there has to be a second knowingly requirement in this, what we are saying is that it is possible to do something knowingly by accidental means.
Remind me, what's the language that's omitted when it's a misdemeanor? This is the felony.
Yes, the language that is omitted is the by willful or wanton disregard so as to interfere with or endanger operation of a police vehicle, et cetera. It is not, technically, it is not just that language omitted. The legislative history for the misdemeanor actually indicates that it is not, for instance, a lesser included offense because the misdemeanor also requires that shall knowingly resist the traffic officer by failing to stop as promptly as safely possible. So technically, it's not a lesser included because there are added requirements for the misdemeanor that are not required for the felony, but the basic difference in the two is this requirement of willful or wanton disregard of the signal. So when we look at the the language. We also have to look at the structure. The structure of the statute provides three different types of fleeing. There is the forfeiture fleeing, there is a misdemeanor fleeing, there is a felony fleeing. And obviously the legislature set up these gradations of different offenses to address more differences in aggravation, aggravating factors. Misdemeanor is more aggravated than the forfeiture, and the felony is more aggravated than the misdemeanor. And in addition, there are also various levels of felonies based on whether or not there was injury or death. However, the fact that there are the three different levels indicates that there should be something more to the felony than to the misdemeanor. Now, if we just make this, as the state would ask, knowingly fleeing or eluding by essentially knowingly fleeing, then we're merging the felony with the misdemeanor. And this is especially so when you look at the Stenzinger case. Because in the Stenzinger case, the Court of Appeals said, number one, you don't need to know, the defendant does not need to know that you are risking interfering with anybody or that you are endangering anybody. You don't need to know that. And also the Stenzinger case says, in fact, you don't even have to actually interfere with anybody or endanger anybody. That's a Stenzinger case. So when we read the state's argument in light of Stenzinger, basically what we're coming down to is a merging of the felony with the misdemeanor. And I don't think that the legislature intended that. I think the legislature intended, by setting up this structure, to limit felony charges to the most aggravated types of fleeing. And then we look at the purpose here. The state relies on purpose to say, well, if we don't make Mr. Hansen's offense a felony, then he's going to be exonerated. He's going to be off the hook. Because the purpose of these statutes are to encourage cooperation with the police and avoid unsafe driving. But the problem with that argument is that that is the same purpose for the forfeiture. That is the same purpose for the misdemeanor. And it's the same purpose for the felony. Since it is the same purpose for all three, we cannot use that purpose to distinguish between the felony and the misdemeanor. Also, to argue that somehow, unless we read this willful and wanton out of the statute, that we are somehow exonerating people like Mr. Hansen because they're going to get off scot-free, that simply is not the case, because there is no willful or wanton requirement for the misdemeanor. He can still be convicted of a misdemeanor even if he is not acting with the intent to do wrong, as long as he meets the other elements of that.
Counsel, are you saying the willful and wanton disregard applies not just to the willful and wanton disregard of the visual or audible signal so as to interfere with or endanger the operation of the police vehicle, traffic officer, or other vehicles or pedestrians? You're saying the willful and wanton disregard also applies to by increasing the speed of a vehicle and by extinguishing the lights of a vehicle?
No.
Okay, so no. You're just talking about the first bracketed portion.
Exactly. The first alternative there under the felony fleeing statute. Mr. Hansen was not charged under either the other two. The jury wasn't instructed on either of the other two.
I get what you're saying, but I'm just wondering why it would only have to be willful and wanton for that first bracketed portion and not the other two, if it is more than the knowingly requirement. If it is the requirement that you know you're doing wrong, shouldn't that also apply to the speeding and extinguishing lights?
Well, I think that the answer to that is that if you extinguish your lights to try to get away from a police officer, that there is something so inherently dangerous about that, that the legislature, I think, reasonably could have assumed that that is something that is as morally culpable as disregarding the lights and the siren. Same thing with increasing your speed. Speeding those kind of things, you know that you are endangering other people. The place where it is different and where the willful disregard would apply is cases like this, where Mr. Hansen did not speed. He was constantly under the speed limit. He actually complied with the traffic signals and everything other than the lights and siren of the police officer. And as a matter of fact, when he was finally stopped, he was the first in line at the stoplight. If he was trying to speed or elude or get away and didn't care about anyone else, he would have just ran through the stop line.
So I just hear, basically they're saying the willful and wanton sort of...
It's kind of incorporated in it as
subsumed within
conceptually. That. You know, it's incorporated in there because doing those acts are kind of inherently
willful and wanton.
Yeah.
I get your point. Okay. Thank you.
Now, one of the things that I think would help exemplify this is just an analogy. A few years ago, there were stories of an individual who was pretending to be a police officer. He had the light, and he would pull women over and then sexually assault them. Now, if an individual is driving late at night, and that individual sees a light coming up behind them, a woman alone, late at night, under the state's interpretation of this, it would be improper for that person to continue going till you get to a lighted place where you could pull over and stop and be safe and know that you're being safe. Now, there's no reason why that woman would know that the person following her is, in fact, this pretend cop rapist.
Counsel, wouldn't that be up to a fact finder, though, whether that conduct was reasonable under the circumstances?
Well, to make a strict self-defense argument, yes, it certainly would. And also to make...
Oh, I'm talking about your hypothetical. The hypothetical on a dark and lonely road where there have been reports, a vicinity in which there have been reports before about a person impersonating a police officer.
Yep.
Wouldn't that go to a fact finder to determine whether the conduct of continuing on to some place designated as safe was reasonable?
There is.
It seems to me you're making an argument as a matter of law here, when in fact your hypothetical would be one dependent on the facts and circumstances and a determination of the fact finder.
Yes, it would be, and just like Mr. Hansen's.
Right,
is.
And that's exactly the argument that Mr. Hansen had the opportunity to make, I believe, under his self-defense argument. How is this distinction different from the self-defense argument that he made at trial?
Okay. Self-defense is a statutory defense. It requires both a subjective belief that one's actions are necessary to protect oneself, and two, that belief has to be reasonable. Two things. Willfulness requires only, a defense to willfulness requires only the subjective belief.
And just so we're clear, it was willful that the jury was instructed on. The court, I believe, struck wanton.
The standard instructions do not include one. Okay. Correct. But willful was never defined in the instructions. And what we are trying to do here is actually have the court define what willful, or the entire statutory phrase, which is what is important, willful or wanton disregard, what that means. And our argument here is that under traditional language, traditional analysis of what willful means in Wisconsin criminal cases, is that willful requires an intent to do wrong, and the flip side of that is that if you have a subjective belief that what you are doing is legally protected, either self-defense, necessity, whatever, a legal defense, that nullifies willfulness that's required for a conviction.
Assuming that interpretation was accepted by the court, at least as to Deputy Klinkhammer, how does that square with the second deputy who was waiting at the end of the exit. In other words, what was the justification for disregarding that law enforcement's officer?
Okay, and at that point, it is still the same initial belief in the need to protect himself. He had subjectively, we're talking, perhaps it's not reasonable. Perhaps that's why the court or the jury deemed the self-defense not to apply. We don't know. But that doesn't change the subjective determination of whether he subjectively believed that he needed to go to a police office or police department where cooler heads would prevail rather than just turning himself over where this guy who had just, in his mind, beat him on the head was still there and part of the chase. So I obviously didn't explain that very well given the look on your face.
Well, I don't think you needed a look. Mr. Hennick, you can understand my puzzlement.
Yes, and it would definitely make, or it could definitely make a difference if we are looking at objective reasonableness. But a subjective good faith belief that your actions are necessary to protect yourself is a defense to willfulness.
And that would be determined, I didn't mean to interrupt.
And that would be determined by the jury, yes.
And didn't the jury already make the determination here?
No. It made a determination that there was not the combination of subjective and objective reasonableness. Or because self-defense requires, again, both subjective belief necessary and objectively reasonable belief.
Yes.
They were given an instruction on self-defense.
Yes.
But they were not given an instruction
on
willful,
yes,
as you wish them to have
exactly
been.
So then the question, under your interpretation, it should be sent back to the jury to determine whether?
Number one, it should be overturned as legally insufficient evidence because it is undisputed that he, in fact, believed that his actions were necessary to protect himself.
From Klinkhammer?
No, that his actions were necessary to protect himself. Number two, that if the court believes that, as Your Honor is referring to here, that there might be sufficient evidence on some other ground, then the issue is sending it back with proper jury instructions so the real controversy can be tried on the issue of willfulness.
Who else or what else besides Deputy Klinkhammer did Mr. Hansen have a subjective belief he was protecting himself from?
I think it was probably just Klinkhammer, because Klinkhammer was the one.
Sorry, it was what?
I think it was probably just Klinkhammer, since Klinkhammer was the one who had hit him over the head with a baton.
Okay, and, well, I believe that part is disputed, Mr.
That part is disputed, yes. But that is the part that he was basing his, and also the what he viewed as irrational conduct at the scene of the original stop. Those are disputed. Which goes to the issue of reasonableness. But the actual subjective, I believe, was just Klinkhammer. Okay. Just very briefly with the issue of victim, I think that the state's argument is trying to create an exception to the definition of victimhood that is consistent throughout the criminal statutes, and that is a person against whom a crime has been committed.
Just switched your argument into an evidentiary ruling about the officer's character,
yes,
by reputation. Okay.
Yes. And that is also an issue of law because it's a interpretation of the statute 904.04 sub 1b. And the victim throughout the criminal statutes is a person against whom a crime has been committed. Here we have fleeing an officer. Crime is committed by fleeing an officer. We have identified the victim. Obstructing an officer. Statute. We identify the victim. The state wants to impose a new exception to that where the government agent is the victim. also seeks to overturn Ortiz and Hayes. There really isn't any basis for such an exception. It would take Officer Klinkhammer, for instance, out of the protections as a victim under the victim's rights legislation. It would take him out of the protections for duty to aid a victim. There's no legal basis identified for distinguishing between a – I see that my time is up.
Finish your sentence. Minutes in rebuttal.
Okay. There's no legal determination or legal basis for distinguishing between physical injury to an officer and injury to the officer's right to control the situation or to have someone remain there. And so, therefore, I would ask that the Court overturn the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. Rebecca Rapp, St. John, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Please, the Court. The defendant seeks a subjective good faith defense to the felony fleeing statute that exonerates people who flee as a means to another
counsel,
end.
Counsel, I wonder if you could pull that microphone closer to you, please. Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. He interprets willful or wanton as creating a subjective good faith defense for people who had a reason, however unreasonable, for fleeing beyond just getting away from police. Now, the problem with this is that he claims to be starting with a statutory text, as we're supposed to, but the statute has nothing in it that would support looking at the defendant's subjective good faith or reasons for fleeing. It shows, as the Court of Appeals found, two purposes for the felony fleeing statute. One is cooperation with law enforcement. The second one is protecting public safety. There's simply nothing in the statutory scheme that in any way implies anything about a person's reasons for fleeing. Now, in order to get around the statutory text, the defendant begins by looking back at century-old case law and different definitions of willful or wanton. Now, I want to point the Court to the case State v. Sissel, which I discuss, and I think that is probably determinative of how this case should be resolved. Now, on page 11 of my brief, I talk about knowingly. I think the word I probably should have used is intentionally. And in reading Sissel, it gets back to that. Sissel involved a consideration of a felony abandonment statute in which the term willful was used, and a misdemeanor failure to support statute in which the word intentional was used. The defendant claimed, raised equal protection claims, saying that it's the prosecutor gets to decide what he's charging, and that's not fair if there's two identical statutes. Well, this Court said that the two crimes are identical in the beginning part of its analysis. It distinguished the cases Preston and the Department of Transportation cases on which the defendant relies, saying those cases involved comparison of criminal and civil. It didn't look at the terms willful and intentional in two criminal statutes. And then it looked at the definition of intent, criminal intent, in 939.23.3, and it discounted Preston as predating that statute. Now, I went back and looked at that statute, and also said that the term willful in the felony abandonment statute just construed, it showed a definition, it was just for a general statement of mens rea element of criminal intent. Now, I think as the common law has proceeded, we've come up with statutory definitions of intent and try to, and the definition has two meanings. One is purposeful and one is knowingly. And I think that that's the definition that the willful or wanton in this felony fleeing statute should be interpreted as. Now, after looking at the common law, the defendant also looks at.
They don't dispute that he intended to disregard the signal, do they?
No.
The defendant's argument is that what he did might not constitute self-defense, but that in his own mind what he was doing was defending himself, and that that's appropriate defense. This brings back to mind, and I don't think anybody cited this case, but many years ago the Court had a case, and I wrote it, where two young men, or I guess it was a young man and his younger sister, were driving to the Capitol, to run an errand for their father, a lawyer, who had to file a brief here. And they were coming down out of the I-90 system. And the young lad who was driving saw a car behind him that was an unmarked car that was, he thought, following him too closely. And he thought the unmarked car was playing games with him, and he thought his sister was in danger. And so he sped. He speeded up on the highway. Turned out this car was an unmarked police car, which then pulled him over and gave him a ticket. And they appealed all the way up here. And the issue was that on the face of the speeding statute, it's no mens rea required. You either were speeding or you weren't speeding. It doesn't matter if you intended to speed or your odometer was wrong. It's just a flat offense. And the court said, you have a defense. And it was protection of others, even if it wasn't self-defense under the statute. And isn't that what the defendant is arguing here? It's arguing that I knew the officer wanted me to stop. I knew it was an officer. I intentionally did not stop because I had a subjective fear that I was going to be hurt. Now, I don't know enough about the facts here as to whether the second officer, the defendant knew the second officer was working with the first officer, or whether he thought that if it came to a stop and there were two officers, the officers would defend each other in line with the general rule of defending one's fellow officer. But isn't that the defense here? And how do you if you don't think that's the defense, tell me. And how do you respond as to whether that is a defense? And unlike that speeding case, which had zilch in it as a defense, here you do have the words willful and wanton disregard.
I think therein lies, I think you've nailed it on the head about what the defense is trying to do, and I think that therein lies the problem. He had his day in court on his self-defense.
That's right.
Our legislature has defined that it requires amount of reasonableness, A, in the concern about unlawful harm to your person, right, and in B, and I think this is important here, that there's no other alternative. This is the only thing that you could have done. So this guy could only drive 10 miles when the 911 operator is imploring him to stop and offering to send somebody else, and another cop shows off. This is the only thing that he could do. So he had his day in court on that. Now he's trying to stretch the interpretation of willful or wanton, which I think is best understood as the criminal mens rea or criminal intent, to get a defense that failed in court.
So you agree that there are two intentionals here. No, you agree there's one knowing and one intention, right?
That's what I think the best wording would be, right?
Yeah. So you're changing willful and or wanton disregard to intentional disregard, right?
Right.
Well, the word intentional is defined in the criminal statutes, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And so the legislation knows how to use that word, theoretically.
Right.
Right. So to say that the two phrases are equivalent is contrary to general rules of statutory interpretation.
Based on this court's precedent in Sissel, I believe that that would be the best interpretation in this case.
But it's troublesome.
It's troublesome that they didn't use the word intentional, but I don't think it supports stretching the term to create some irrational self-defense defense.
How does the word intentional add anything? He knowingly flees, right?
Right.
So he has to know the facts, right? So does he know the fact that he received a visual or audible signal?
Right.
Right? He knows he's got a visible or audible signal, and he flees, or he attempts to elude it, right? So he flees. And then it says, by intentionally disregarding such signal. It doesn't make sense to me. If he knows it's a signal and he flees.
Right.
It has to be intentional.
Right.
So that, why does you're taking you're reading out the words? I suggest you're reading out the words willful or wanton disregard of such signal so as to blah blah blah.
I think that I'm not defending that the statute's the best written statute, but when you look at the purposes of the statute, you also consider the criminal intent statute, which was first created in 1955, predating the statute. You look at CISL and the precedent interpreting willful as meaning intentional, and I think that that's the best read of the statute, and you consider the purposes of this statute.
We agree that willful or wanton is differently defined in different circumstances in different statutes, don't we?
Right, but when you read CISL, I mean, the best that it gets the defendant is that you have to go back to the statute because it says you look at different contexts. That's what this court said in CISL. But when you really read it carefully, it distinguished when it was talking about context, it almost seemed to be separating out criminal cases and civil or tort type of cases. So it could almost be read to suggest that criminal cases, if they indicate a mens rea, that should be interpreted as criminal intent. And there's a lot of reasons, even for notice for defendants, why we'd want intent defined in one way in every criminal statute.
Well, you think it is?
I'm not saying that it is, no, but I'm saying that that would be desirable.
I know, but I have a sense that if I went through the statutes carefully, intent would be defined differently or used differently. But maybe not.
Another thing that the defendant focuses on for support from getting away what I would interpret as the best or put forth as the best interpretation of the statute is legislative history. When you look at the legislative history, though, I believe it actually contradicts his argument. If you look at 346.042...
The statute is unambiguous on its face. I mean, I want you to, before you go into legislative history, tell me if you think it's ambiguous or unambiguous.
I believe it's unambiguous.
Okay, so then you have to have legislative history to support your argument.
If it's unambiguous, no. I'm just refuting the defendant's arguments at this point because he made a point about the misdemeanor statute that I believe.
Right.
He says that the misdemeanor statute supports his argument because willful or wanton has to mean something else, but there's nothing in the legislative history in the misdemeanor statute to indicate that it was enacted because of his interpretation of willful or wanton. In fact, it shows a focus on dangerousness, which I submit is one of the purposes of the felony fleeing statute. On page 31 of the defendant's appendix, it said some prosecutors are hesitant to pursue the cases as felonies because some are less dangerous than others, and some judges are hesitant and about it as well. And it really focused on A, looking at the level of dangerousness, and B, giving prosecutors the ability to determine and exercise their discretion about how to charge cases. And in fact, in this case, it was initially charged as a misdemeanor, and then it was recharged as a felony. That's in the appendix, or the record at 38 at page 5. And this CISL, and then this point gets back to a point that the defendant also made. He's like, you know, these statutes can't be identical. Well, in fact, given CISL, they could potentially, they're not identical, they're not lesser included or anything, but they could be identical, and it's up to a prosecutor to look at the case, consider the level of dangerousness, and determine how to charge the case. Now, getting back to the statute itself, when you look at it, Justice Ziegler asked a question about the increasing speed and whether or not willful or wanton would there be a subjective good faith defense for that as well. Now, contrary to what was suggested, the defendant could have been charged under the increasing speed. It wasn't that you're speeding, it's that you increase your speed. And he went from 0 to 65, even if he was going in the speed limit. He increased his speed. Now, the prosecutor didn't charge the case as such. He tried to bring it up later, but it was too late because it was during trial, and we're not relying on that theory now. But it sort of underscores the problem with this subjective good faith defense. Why would it only apply to the first prong but not the increasing speed or the extinguishing lights?
Because that's the statute doesn't apply it. The statute is written, has... First of all, shall knowingly flee or attempt to elude so as to, by willful wanton. And then it has a different clause which reads, really, although grammatically it's not written that way, no operator of a vehicle, after having received a visual or audible signal from a traffic officer, shall increase the speed of the operator's vehicle. That's how it reads. It doesn't have, when you read the that part, the words knowingly flee or attempt to elude. Do you read that otherwise? Do you read willful and wanton into each clause?
No, I don't. And to me, that underscores or provides support for the state's position. It doesn't make any sense that there'd be a subjective good faith in defense for the first prong, but not the second two. They all require levels of dangerousness. So there's no reason that you'd have that defense towards one and not the others, particularly given that this case could have been charged as an increasing speed case.
Well, you don't have knowing in that either. Operator doesn't have to knowingly increase the speed.
I believe that increasing the speed, it would be implicit that they were knowingly increasing the speed or knowingly turning off their lights. I mean, I guess you could just increase your speed and not.
Well, it could be an accident that you mistake in a hurry. People sometimes put on the gas instead of the brake.
Right.
Or the car can have a defect that it accelerates without doing anything. I mean, that's known to happen. Doesn't happen every day, but it's known to happen. And I don't know whether any of those would be defenses.
I think they both imply a level of knowledge. I know that there's cases where you could accidentally flip off your lights, but I think that it suggests a level of knowledge that fleeing, maybe you don't realize it's a traffic officer. But it does not make any sense given the purpose that there'd be a subjective good faith defense for.
You don't have to worry about the last two, though, right?
We do from the standpoint that we're looking at a statute,
okay,
and we have to interpret words in context with the statute.
Does the Sturzinger case that you rely on and cite to stand for the proposition that knowingly only in the statutory context applies to the only to the fleeing or attempting to elude an officer? Recall that?
Yes. It says that it only applies to fleeing or attempting to flee. You don't have to know that you're causing or endangering others. It was a court of appeals case, so I don't rely on it here.
I have a question about that. You have in your brief at page 34 that this court isn't bound by the court of appeals decision. I think it's page 34. Do you have that?
Yes, I do.
I mean, is that the state's position?
That this court's not bound by court of appeals decisions? Yes, that would be.
We are the only ones who can overrule the court of appeals decision is what you suggest.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Right, but we are bound by it until it's overruled. I mean, we'd have to specifically overrule it. Otherwise, it's binding on the court, and the court can cite it, right?
I mean, you can cite it. I believe that you would have authority to overturn a case of a court of appeals.
We could even overturn our own cases.
Right, you can.
But until we do, we're bound by them. They're precedent.
I think this court's bound by its own precedent.
But you don't think we're bound by the Court of Appeals precedent? Is that
I think
there
would be more
position?
Persuasive authority in this court rather than
precedential
precedent.
All right. They concluded in, and I'm reading from Judge Deininger's case, we conclude, however, that the scienter requirement applies only to the first element of the offense, that a driver knowingly flees or attempt to elude. We conclude the statute does not require the operator of a fleeing vehicle to actually interfere with or endanger, identify a vehicle. He or she need only drive in a manner that creates the risk. That's what they summarize their holding as.
Right.
And you agree with that?
Do I agree that that's the holding of that case?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to turn to the second part now about the victimless crimes, or whether it's a victimless, or whether the evidence was improperly admitted.
And just to be clear, Sturzinger didn't raise the issue of what willful disregard means.
No.
The defendant there, the defense was that he didn't actually interfere with or endanger. That's what the case was about.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. When it comes to a defendant wanting to admit evidence, I think it's sort of my knee-jerk reaction. Why not just let him admit the evidence? What's the big deal, right? So I've got 3 points I want to address to explain why it would be a big deal just to let defendant or Deputy Klinkhammer be treated as a victim in this case. Number one, he talks about an exception being, I want to create an exception to this, whether he's a victim or not. The character of the victim is an exception to a general rule that we have about not allowing propensity and character evidence. We want trials to be about what actually happened and what's being tried. We don't want it to be about the character of somebody or other acts evidence or those sorts of things. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. And it starts out with there's a line-drawing problem. If Deputy Klinkhammer's a victim in this case, what about the passers-by or other people? As it was noted by the Court of Appeals, Deputy Klinkhammer wasn't injured. There was nothing acute injury that he suffered other than just his directions and instructions not being followed. Another consideration is that this, admitting this evidence or treating Deputy Klinkhammer as a victim would have huge implications beyond this
case. Suppose he had gotten hurt.
Then there'd probably
but there was no charge of that. The only charge was what we have here. Do you allow this evidence? He is a victim. It's just that he's not, the charge is not particularly on that offense.
Right. And I've thought about whether he could be a potential victim. I think the cleanest rule would be no, you follow what the person's being charged with. But even if you were going to have a bigger rule, like you look at the underlining facts and consider whether there were other charges that could have been brought, he still wouldn't qualify as a victim in this particular case.
Well, maybe did the defendant err by not bringing in his other acts, or his other acts only relating to the defendant?
Pardon?
Is another exception, other acts evidence, right? Which you can bring in for plan, motive, intent, et cetera.
Yes.
And other things, right?
Right.
Would that cover this case, or does that only apply to defendants' other acts?
The other acts exception doesn't only apply to defendants. So I don't think there were any other acts, but potentially if he had other acts, he could have tried to admit them for some purpose.
Well,
I believe
the superintendent must have known of other acts in order to form a reputation.
Well, I don't know that's not in the record.
Makes sense, right?
I don't know. She could provide this character evidence, and that's all I know. So the implications I want to talk about for law enforcement, even taking the drug case, for example, that's a prototypical victimless crime. Defendants are victim, or police officers would be involved in that crime. You could imagine a defendant saying, well, this police officer has a reputation for being a trickster. One time he put lake water in my coffee, and another time he put a Vikings jersey in my locker, or whatever. In this case, a fleeing or obstruction case, you could always try to say, the officer made me do it. He's a bad person. It would come up almost in potentially every case.
And there have been a number of cases where they've attempted to, the defendant has attempted to introduce evidence about the record, disciplinary record of an officer. It's generally been ruled as irrelevant.
Right. I also want to talk about the other arguments. First, I believe that the defendant forfeited his evidentiary and constitutional arguments altogether. He raised them in the Court of Appeals and in his petition for review in this court solely in the context of an interest of justice claim. And he grouped together a lot of different evidentiary issues. So he didn't squarely raise this until his brief in this case.
Now, that argument not only goes to the constitutional argument, it goes to the whole evidentiary argument.
Exactly, the whole evidentiary issue.
Because the defendant says that even though you raised it in interest of justice as to the evidence, the constitutional argument was never raised.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
He raised it in the circuit court. He said that it would violate his right to prevent a defense, but he didn't preserve that argument on appeal or raise it on appeal.
Thank you.
Even if you were going to find that Deputy Klinkhammer was a victim, in his brief, the defendant asks, well, that's all you consider. But in fact, that's not all that courts consider when they consider whether to introduce evidence. They also consider whether evidence is relevant, and then they consider whether its probative value is substantially outweighed by other considerations. I believe that this would also provide a basis for excluding the evidence. And the standard of review, if you were going to consider the evidentiary issue, would be an erroneous exercise of discretion. So in exercising or applying the independent review doctrine, this court could find other rationales for excluding the evidence. There's a couple things to discuss here. Number one, the evidence that he sought to admit was principal's testimony about this Deputy Klinkhammer's character, reputation around the school for being hot-headed and confrontational. It was never... That's not the same as saying that the defendant was illegally interfered with or that Deputy Klinkhammer was violent or that the defendant had a reasonable apprehension for his safety or his life. I don't think Deputy Klinkhammer didn't even dispute that he was confrontational with this guy on I-94. And most people, or a lot of people, would expect that a police officer would get rather confrontational with someone on I-94 who continued to get out of his car and didn't stop. So the evidence itself really didn't add that much. It wasn't about a big disputed fact. Secondly, the defendant was able to present his defense. This is underscored by the fact that he got the self-defense instruction. And the circuit court said at the beginning of the trial that he would not give this self-defense defense unless it was warranted by the evidence. So it obviously found that he presented enough of a self-defense defense to warrant the instruction. Third, the defendant was able to present other evidence supporting his defense. He testified, and really the only thing that went to danger as such was his testimony that he got hit on the head. Now, this was refuted by Deputy Klinkhammer and Randy Derby, who was a ride-along in the car. He also had four character witnesses who testified on his behalf regarding his truthfulness. So he was able to present that evidence. Now, lastly, the defendant said that a decision in this case, not finding that Deputy Klinkhammer was a victim, would lead to an overturning of Haas and would keep police officers from ever getting restitution. That's simply not true. This statute's entirely different than the restitution statute. When you read the restitution cases, they're really focused on the Haas case in particular, never awarded the officer in that case restitution. It was a sheriff's department seeking restitution for a car, and they engaged in a very fact-specific causal analysis about who suffered the harm. That's very different than this case. One last point in terms of the willful or wanton. Fleeing, in my mind, is an inherently dangerous activity. This man, the defendant, chose to put his interests ahead of public safety. He endangered others, and he had other alternatives to stop. So the idea that it required some extra animus on his part is a little bit difficult for me to understand, that argument.
Let me just, since you're getting back to the statute, you indicate the statute is clear, unambiguous, and yet I see that the statute has the word wanton, and yet you're taking that out in your interpretation, and the statute does not have the word intentional, but you seem to be putting it in. So what's so clear about that? I mean, we have to, you know, embrace these words, except you're tossing one out and then you're putting one in that doesn't exist. So how is that consistent with something that is unambiguous? It seems to me there's some ambiguity, and you're arguing for purpose and legislative history, et cetera. Can you just clarify that or respond, please?
Right. No. First, I took the wanton out because in the jury instruction that was given here, wanton was excluded, and that's consistent with the standard jury instruction. In the notes to the standard jury instruction, the committee said that they took wanton out because it doesn't add anything to willful, and you can add it if it's appropriate in a particular case. The defendant didn't seek it in this case. So
I might have a forfeiture there, perhaps, a forfeiture of a request, but just in the vernacular, it seems to me willful's different than what.
I'm not treating it as a forfeiture argument because I believe that, you know, the defendant couldn't be convicted of not committing a crime, but I do believe that it underscores that willful or wanton is treated as one term, even though it's disjunctive, it's treated as a singular term. And when I read Sissel and I consider the background of the criminal intent statute, I believe that the best read of that is intentional. I always have problems with statutory interpretation about whether statutes are ambiguous or not. You're supposed to consider context, and there's all these things you can consider in determining whether the statute's plain or not.
You're not alone.
But I believe that when you consider the structure of this statute, all the various parts, you put together the three different provisions, you put that against the background of the criminal intent statute, I believe the statute is not ambiguous. You don't need to be getting into legislative history and things like that to be trying to interpret the statute or to create ambiguity where there is none. Are there any other questions?
Think not. Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hennick. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kissel is probably the strongest argument that the state has on the issue of willful or wanton, because it is only Kissel that gives them a basis for arguing that willfully should mean nothing more than intentionally or knowingly. However, Kissel is not applicable here for at least three reasons. First reason is that Kissel recognized that the term willfully is inherently ambiguous. It's used in different ways in different cases, so it's not directly controlling. It didn't say that willfully always means intentionally or willfully always means knowingly. So we still have to look at this particular statute that we're dealing with today. Second, in applying or interpreting willfully as intentionally, in the Kissel case, this court was not facing the situation where doing so would render the language willful or wanton disregard a nullity or surplusage. In that case, you were trying to determine what the statute meant, whether willfully meant something more than intentionally or only intentionally. Under neither interpretation is the word simply written out of the statute. In this case, the state is arguing that we just take willfully or wantonly out of the statute and replace it with a redundant mens rea requirement that already is there.
Mr. Hennick, at the beginning of her questioning of Ms. St. John, the Chief Justice summarized your argument in regard to the term willful, the subject of our colloquy, and as you say, my puzzlement, which is true. And she said, when she did it, she started out by saying that your argument in regard to willful would be, it might not have been self-defense, but in his own mind, his actions were necessary. Is that an accurate summary of your position?
Basically, yes.
Would that be subject, in your argument, to a reasonableness determination by a fact finder?
No.
Okay, so as soon as the defendant, now we're getting to the source of my puzzlement.
Okay.
So as soon, and your argument runs, that as soon as a defendant gives any justification that in his or her own mind made his or her actions necessary, then that is the defense.
No.
Okay, then you can't have it both ways.
I'm getting you confused.
Both cannot be true.
I'll try to clarify. Our argument is that willful or wanton disregard requires that the defendant intended not merely to do the act, but to do wrong, and that a subjective good faith belief that one's actions are legally defensible, not something like I have to get to the Packers game or I'm late to a Supreme Court argument, but legally defensible, such as self-defense or necessity.
But if it's not subject to a reasonable determination by a fact finder, how would that ever come into play?
It would come into play because there still is whether the question for the fact finder of whether or not this person in fact subjectively believed that it was necessary. A jury under a different set of circumstances certainly could look at what the defendant has to say. And if the defendant says, oh, yeah, I thought I was going to get killed, and the jury didn't believe that.
That sounds an awful lot like a reasonableness determination.
Well, obviously, if something is not reasonable, then that is a factor that is taken into account by the jury in determining whether or not he had a subjective belief. But it still can be a subjective belief, even if it's not reasonable.
Let's see if I can help. Most mens rea in criminal cases, especially serious criminal cases, is subjective.
Yes.
So if I swing a bat and kill somebody, and I'm really swinging, I think I'm swinging at a mosquito, or swinging in the air, and I have no intent of hitting anyone and don't even know that this guy is behind me, I'm probably not guilty of murder.
Exactly.
If the jury doesn't believe that, and the jury thinks that, hey, this guy has been, he and I have had problems before, I knew he was in the area, on the street, that people just don't go around swinging at the air or mosquitoes, and therefore was my intent in swinging to hit him. So yes, even that's my subjective belief. The jury doesn't have to believe that subjective belief and applies, in effect, an object. It says, I just don't believe him because that's not the way most people act. There's enough evidence here to say he didn't act, right?
Exactly. It's a difference between objectiveness, objective reasonableness, as being an element of a defense or a crime, and as being an evidentiary, a means of evaluating evidence. And, you know, it can be both, but what we are arguing in this case is that it is not a requirement for a defense to willful or wanton.
Even if we accepted your argument that it's subjective, doesn't mean your client would be free on a new trial, because a jury might not believe that.
Exactly, if there was a new trial. If the court held that the evidence was sufficient to convict and therefore rejects my sufficiency argument and instead reverses and remands for a new trial with proper jury instruction, yes.
How can, if there was really wrong instructions here, that is because willful and or wanton wasn't given, why do we look at sufficiency of evidence, this error here?
Oh, because if the evidence was insufficient to convict, then double jeopardy would bar.
I understand that law. I'm just saying to you, how can you say the conviction was or was not on sufficient evidence when there's significant error, which is your basic argument?
Well, there was significant error, but what we are arguing is that even if the jury was properly instructed, they would not have been able to reasonably reach that conclusion.
Got it. Even if properly instructed, the
yes.
Words I have to add. Thank you.
Yes. Thank
are there
you.
Any other questions? If not, that concludes our argument on State v. Hansen, and I want to thank Mr. Hennick and Ms. St. John for their arguments today on yet another difficult statutory interpretation of questions. The court is in recess until 1:30 when we are scheduled for the third case. We are in recess.